From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The three House committees overseeing the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump have begun a new phase into their month-long probe, with the public release of transcripts of closed-door hearings this week and the start of public hearings next week. So far, what's been released are the transcripts of testimonies from U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, the former ambassador, that is, high-level State Department official Michael McKinley, former Special Envoy Kurt Volker, and Gordon Sondland, the U.S. Ambassador to the European Union. Sondland, a Trump loyalist, was called back in to revise his earlier testimony and now confirms the quid pro quo arrangement Trump was seeking with Ukraine, prompting Republicans like Senator Lindsey Graham to speculate that he might be in cahoots with Democrats. Next week, a number of those who have already testified will reappear before the committees for public hearings. We return now to Capitol Hill to turn to our correspondent, Mitch Jezrich. He's a Pacifica reporter, host of Letters and Politics, heard on KPFA and KPFK, and he's been in Washington, D.C. covering the impeachment inquiry. Welcome back to the show, Mitch.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
So each week we have you on, there is more and more to talk about. This week, of course, based on the resolution that was passed by the House last week, we saw the release of these handful of transcripts that have come out so far. And there's been a lot in them, but I feel like the Sondland transcript is the most damning given his revision. So explain why you think Sondland revised his testimony and how he revised it. What was the revision?
Well, some of this is speculation, of course. And Gordon Sondland, the reason you come back to revise your transcript is because you think something in there is either incorrect that you said before, or perhaps you've heard news from other people's testimony. And, you know, there could be a legitimate reason. Maybe your memory was jarred. And you remembered something that you forgot about earlier, so you come back and want to revise your transcript. It's not an uncommon process through all this. In fact, on Thursday, Alexander Vindman returned to Capitol Hill to revise his testimony as well. So it's a common thing that many other members have done. But what's significant, as you indicate, with Gordon Sondland, who is the ambassador to the European Union, who himself has said was the point person for Donald Trump in trying to create a meeting between Trump and Ukrainian President Zelensky, is that Gordon Sondland changed his story to say that it very much was a quid pro quo, meaning that in order for Ukraine to get the $391 million in military aid and to get a meeting with Donald Trump, a face-to-face meeting between Ukrainian President Zelensky and Donald Trump, that it would be dependent on Ukraine to make a public statement that it was going to investigate Burisma, the Ukrainian oil company, the Bidens, both Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, as well as this theory that Ukraine was the one that was actually interfering in the 2016 election. And of course, this gets at the heart of what the impeachment matter is all about, that Donald Trump had abused his power. And to have Gordon Sondland now say it was a quid pro quo is very significant. But I will add one more thing, and Gordon Sondland may have given the Republicans who are backing the president and the president himself a way out. He said that he assumed it was a quid pro quo, but not that Donald Trump had actually told him it was a quid pro quo. In fact, told him it wasn't a quid pro quo, just that he wanted Sondland to force Zelensky to do the right thing. That's what Gordon Sondland said. So,
but does it matter what Sondland or Trump's opinion of the definition of a quid pro quo is?
Well, you could say that, right? So, but I guess what Sondland was saying was that he was assuming it was a quid pro quo, that it was, you know, again, for to get something for something, to get the $391 million in military aid, to get the White House meeting was going to be dependent on these investigations occurring. That so Sondland believed, and he said he assumed it was a quid pro quo. regardless if we're talking about the definition of what quid pro quo means, what he did not say was that Donald Trump told me to get these things in exchange for these things. And that's kind of significant, and that's giving the Republicans a talking point, including next week when William Taylor will testify in the first hearing on November 13th to the House Intelligence Committee, the first hearing that will be open to the public, because William Taylor, his transcript has been released as well from his deposition, and William Taylor also, even though he believed and he said that there was definitely a quid pro quo, not just for the military aid and not just for the White House meeting, that the entire relationship between Ukraine and the United States was on the line if Ukraine did not announce that it would do these investigations, which of course is really significant because the U.S. is a big supporter of the Ukrainian government, as Ukraine is in this sort of quasi-civil war with the United States, other Western European countries on one side, and Russia on the other side. But William Taylor never talked to Donald Trump himself. The highest level that he heard from concerning what he thought was a quid pro quo was from Rudy Giuliani. And we've heard that from several other people who have testified as well. What we haven't had, and we could argue about what the transcript proves, you know, Donald Trump thinks that the transcript exonerates him. You know, you watch his rallies now, and people there have T-shirts that say, read the transcript. So beyond the transcript, what we haven't heard from yet in these depositions is somebody like John Bolton, who did not show up on Thursday when the committee asked him to give a deposition, or Mick Mulvaney, who is scheduled to show up on Friday. Very doubtful Mick Mulvaney, the White House chief of staff, is going to show up. The national security advisor, who was John Bolton at the time, and Mick Mulvaney, who's still the White House chief of staff. These are the two individuals, these are the two positions that are the closest to the president. And any order that would have come from Donald Trump would have went through either Mick Mulvaney or John Bolton. And of course, they're not testifying at this point. So that's
I want to get to Bolton in just a moment, but just staying on Sondland for a minute. So you're suggesting that in saying that Trump didn't order him to pursue a quid pro quo, that he's offering a way out, but already his statement appears to be incriminating enough to Republicans that they have begun trashing him. When asked about Sondland's testimony and why he changed and revised his testimony on Fox News, Senator Lindsey Graham, who's one of Trump's top allies, said, is there a connection between Sondland and Democratic operatives on the committee? Did he talk to Schiff? Did he talk to Schiff's staffers? He said that it makes me incredibly suspicious. Why did Sondland change his mind? But I mean, given that Vindman and Taylor and Yovanovitch and all of these others have been confirming the same thing and have basically had a very consistent testimony, isn't it possible that Sondland just didn't want to perjure himself?
I think it's likely. I think you hit it right on the hammer on the nail. I think that's probably, I mean, I'm not in Sondland's head, so I got to be a little careful about that. But very likely he did not want to perjure himself, that everyone else gave corroborating testimonies. His was the one that was different. Once, and he came back twice, actually, to revise his transcript. Once on Monday, and then the week before he came back and revised his transcript. So he's done it a couple of times. Again, it's not unusual to do it. Other people have done it as well. But I think there's a very good chance, and I think it would be reasonable to suspect he did not want to perjure himself. But his testimony, along with everyone else's testimony, that paints basically the same picture. What it's missing is an order from Donald Trump himself. Now, you can infer, well, this had to come from the very top. But no one who has testified actually was talking beyond Sondland, who said he assumed this is what Donald Trump wanted, not that he was ordered from Donald Trump that this is what he wanted. That's what's missing so far. The one person who could say, right, yes, I was given this order from the president. And I think we're going to hear a lot about that in these open hearings that are coming up.
So let's talk about John Bolton. Not a liberal by any stretch of the imagination, a very severe war hawk who had been vainly trying to push Trump into war with Iran, and who still says he agrees with the president on, you know, most things. He left the White House under strain, you know, under circumstances we don't quite know yet. Now there's speculation that the reason he might have left the White House was because he saw that this Ukraine scandal was unfolding. The Washington Post spoke to anonymous sources who said he was willing to testify. He didn't show up on Thursday. He said he would respond to a subpoena. So why doesn't the House subpoena him?
Well, that's an interesting question. And he said he wouldn't testify unless he was subpoenaed. But then what would happen if he was subpoenaed and then the White House would respond by trying to block his testimony? Right. So you could say if you're subpoenaed, you're supposed to, you're legally bound to testify. But then what happens when the president uses his executive authority? This is where it gets tricky with the separation of powers between executive and legislative. What would he have done it then? So let's say he gets subpoenaed, and then Donald Trump, as he has done with everyone else, ordered witnesses not to testify. Would he have still testified if Donald Trump ordered him not to after he was subpoenaed? Gets a little complicated there. But we already have that case that happened earlier with Charles Kupperman, who was John Bolton's top aide as National Security Advisor. John Bolton was the National Security Advisor. And that's the exact scenario that happened with Charles Kupperman. And what Charles Kupperman did was he went to a judge and he asked the judge to determine who he should obey. Should he obey the White House or should he obey Congress? And that was in process. And a judge said that he would have oral arguments on December 10th. And there are other members of the administration, like John Eisenberg, the White House official, who Alexander Vindman said started the process to remove the record of the conversation between Trump and Zelensky from one computer server to a more highly classified computer server so less people could get to it. John Eisenberg himself said he was waiting to see what was going to happen with Charles Kupperman.
And isn't there also a case involving former White House counsel Don McGahn that I understand Bolton's lawyers are also closely watching around a sort of parallel issue?
Yeah, I'm not as clear on that one. Mm-hmm. I was mostly following the Charles Kupperman case. So I'd probably be out of line to talk about McGahn because I don't know that one intimately. Mm-hmm. But Charles Kupperman and John Bolton do share the same attorney. So it's very likely that would have been the same strategy. Here's what happened on Wednesday, though, that really surprised me. And that is that the House dropped its subpoena to Charles Kupperman and asked the judge to drop the case altogether. So this case that everyone was waiting on to see what was going to happen with Charles Kupperman is now no longer going forward, because these three House committees that had subpoenaed him have dropped the subpoena. They've withdrew the subpoena. He's no longer been subpoenaed to come talk here, which presents an interesting situation for other people who have been subpoenaed but yet have refused to turn up because they may be in some legal limbo.
So do you think that the House withdrew its subpoena because they worried that the court could rule in favor of Trump, and then that would essentially stymie their impeachment inquiry altogether? So they're sort of hoping to operate in this legal limbo, in this legal, gray zone?
Yeah, the official word from the House is they did it because they did not want to delay this process anymore. They want to move forward with the impeachment. Democratic leaders have indicated that they want to vote on articles of impeachment on the floor of the House of Representatives by the end of the year. And that we've heard from Mitch McConnell, who's not on the same side, obviously, as the Democrats, also say that that the trial would probably last about a month in the Senate. That's how long the trial lasted for Bill Clinton in 1998, and they kind of want to be done with all of this by February before the primaries begin. We're getting very close to the primaries. It's very possible. And remember, there are several senators who are going to be jurors in a trial if Donald Trump is impeached and you get the trial in the Senate. There are several senators that are running for president, which creates a very interesting situation, how the impeachment can actually interfere with the primaries and the Iowa caucus itself. So that's what the Democrats said. They said that the reason they withdrew it is because they don't want to wait any longer. I also wonder about this legal limbo. You know, Adam Schiff always has believed that Charles Kupperman was actually violating the law by not coming to the House and testifying, that Kupperman going to a federal judge to ask who he should obey was in of itself a violation of the law, because if Congress subpoenas you to come testify, you must do that. And so it does create this legal limbo that maybe they were worried about the judge ruling against the House. But maybe it's possible there's some game being played here that's actually over my head. And maybe they're also putting these other folks that were waiting to see what happened in Charles Kupperman's case, putting them in a difficult situation, in a little more legal limbo, to see if that could coerce them to come testify.
Hmm. I want to ask you about a sort of side issue that is not directly related to how the House committees are conducting their impeachment, but this news that Trump asked his attorney general, William Barr, to hold a press conference soon after the rough transcript of the Zelensky phone call was made public. The story is that Trump asked Barr to go before the public, say in a press conference that there was nothing wrong, that Trump did nothing wrong, and that Barr refused. Of course, Trump is denying that that happened. But that's an interesting aside, because if Barr refused, he might have clearly seen the writing on the wall. And although Barr has gone to bat for Trump on many, many occasions, you know, to the point where he's been accused of acting like Trump's personal lawyer, it seems as though it's possible he might have drawn the line here. Again, making it pretty difficult for other Republicans then to back Trump if Attorney General Barr himself is not willing to defend Trump in public. And Trump looks increasingly more guilty.
Yeah, so that I think that story was by the Washington Post, mm-hmm. who was talking to unnamed sources within the White House about that dynamic. And that's why we know about it. Both Donald Trump and William Barr have denied that story. But it's a little bit hard for me to talk about it, because I obviously was not on the inside and haven't had sources to talk to about that story in particular. The Justice Department's reaction to it is that the Justice Department had already determined that there was no laws that were violated, that there was no campaign finance laws that were violated from the complaint that came from the whistleblower. You'll remember that the whistleblower and the inspector general did go to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department determined that there was nothing wrong that occurred. So in that sense, the Justice Department
determined that there were no campaign finance laws that were broken, but they, as far as I can tell, didn't actually look into whether, for example, Trump might have violated the Hobbs Act, which is, you know, essentially extortion, or, you know, a lesser version of that, a quid pro quo. As far as I can tell, they didn't actually examine that aspect of it.
Yeah. So again, this is a story that I'm not well versed on to really probably go any further in.
Mitch, what about the Roger Stone trial? Although this particular associate of Trump has been charged in a case that was a side outcome of the special counsel's investigation, all of this trial that this very interesting character is facing is playing out at the same time as this impeachment inquiry. I know it's not getting very much attention, but we heard now that Steve Bannon is expected to be an unexpected witness at that trial. Do you have any sense that, you know, are folks in Washington, D.C. discussing the Roger Stone trial, or has that been kind of relegated to the background because it was related to the Mueller investigation?
Yeah, not on Capitol Hill. And you haven't seen Roger Stone's name connected to this Ukraine story so far. So there's been very little talk here on Capitol Hill concerning his trial.
Let's talk about Rudy Giuliani. The transcripts that were released this week of Marie Yovanovitch and Alexander Vindman and Bill Taylor revealed Giuliani's name hundreds of times. And essentially, there was a sense that he was everywhere and he was hard to control. And he was, you know, essentially directing U.S.'s Ukraine policy. This is the president's personal lawyer, not an appointed official confirmed by the Senate. How deep in trouble is Rudy Giuliani? His name keeps popping up, and he sort of stayed under the radar.
Yeah, you can see a scenario being created here where Rudy Giuliani could be the fall guy in all of this. Of everyone who has testified so far, it all leads back to Rudy Giuliani. And even when people have tried to go to the president, he has told them, go to Giuliani. And so you had Rudy Giuliani, who is not a member of the administration, as you indicated. Rudy Giuliani is a private attorney for Donald Trump, not a White House attorney, not a member of the State Department, not somebody certainly who was confirmed by the United States Senate as an ambassador or an undersecretary or any of these things, these people that you would anticipate leading negotiations concerning foreign affairs. And again, it's Giuliani that everyone says was the one who was spearheading this second channel of foreign policy that was undercutting what your traditional diplomats were doing. So on Wednesday, when we have our first open hearing in the House Intelligence Committee, we're going to hear that very story from William Taylor, who's basically the acting ambassador of Ukraine since the recall of Marie Yovanovitch. But we're also going to hear from George Kent. George Kent was one of the people who gave testimony a long time ago, which seems a long time now anyways, when closed depositions began. And George Kent was responsible for overseeing this area of the world that included Ukraine and Russia, sort of this Eurasia, portion of the globe. And George Kent testified early on that he was immediately sidelined in foreign policy with Ukraine. And sideline so that Rudy Giuliani could take the lead in all of this. So again, is Rudy Giuliani going to testify, right? I mean, what about getting him to testify about where was he getting his orders?
And I wonder if you know what the answer to this or not, but would Giuliani, given that he's not, given that he's a private attorney of the president's, would he be covered by executive privilege if he was subpoenaed and Trump said that he couldn't testify? Or would it be the sort of, attorney-client privilege? But, we're talking about U.S. foreign policy here, not Trump's personal dealings. I'm wondering if you have any idea of the sort of legal loopholes that Giuliani could use to protect himself to not testify.
Yeah, I think the latter that you said there, attorney privilege, yeah. Probably what he would use. Yeah, that's what I would suspect.
Which is just bizarre, given that he's inserting himself into U.S. foreign policy. finally, I want to ask you briefly about the chilling effect that you think has been felt around very concerted efforts to out the name of the whistleblower who originally filed the complaint that triggered the impeachment inquiry. The House has made very strong efforts to protect this person's identity. We did have some media reports expose the fact that this was a man working for the CIA and still working there. But the name so far by mainstream media outlets has been kept secret. But we understand that Donald Trump Jr. has tweeted it and that Trump supporters and allies and Breitbart News have been bandying around this name of this person in public. And that just seems outrageous.
Yeah, there are conservative news outlets that have published the name. It hasn't been proven by others that that's who it is. So even a mainstream news agency like Fox has not come out with the name. But So, you know, what is the chilling effect? I don't know, but it's certainly there's a potential chilling effect. This is the whistleblower that the government considers a whistleblower. Now,
And
Sonali,
hasn't
you and I.
everything that the person put in their complaint essentially been confirmed by people publicly known?
Yes, that's right. But
So
the
what's the
Republicans
point?
are saying this is the person. Well, yeah, I mean that's a strong argument.
It seems as though
That
the only
everything that
point of trying to out this person is some sort of vendetta to blame them for putting Trump in the crosshairs of House committees, which only suggests that these folks who are trying to out him wish him harm.
I think there is the allegation with what they would say, the Republicans would say, is they suspect this is a political operative, somebody who has animus towards Donald Trump. And just like Peter Strzok of the FBI and Lisa Page and the text messages that we got, that, you know, and Peter Strzok was somebody who was instrumental early on in investigating the Trump campaign and Russian interference in the election in 2016. And I think this is, they suspect that there's this feeling that for the Republicans, that this the CIA whistleblower may have the same type of animus towards Donald Trump that we saw from someone like Peter Strzok. So that's what they're saying. They're also saying that if you're going to be convicted of the crime, you have the Sixth Amendment right of the Constitution that would give you the right to confront your accuser, to know who your accuser is. Now you're right, Sonali. Everyone else who has testified not only has confirmed what we've seen from the whistleblower, but has painted much more of a fuller picture than what the whistleblower's original complaint even has in it. But the Republicans are going to continue to try to get the whistleblower's identity known. Jim Jordan, one of Donald Trump's biggest supporters here in the House of Representatives, has already indicated that the Republicans will request a subpoena for the whistleblower to testify in these open hearings. Now, Republicans do have the right to put in a subpoena request, but they can be blocked if the chair of the committee decides to block them, and then it would go to a vote by the whole committee, in which the Democrats have the majority on. So it's very likely that they would be unsuccessful in their attempt to try to get the subpoena, the whistleblower.
Well, Mitch, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I know that you're heading back to Berkeley soon, and we'll be keeping on top of the public hearings as they play out in DC, and I'm sure we'll have you back on. Thanks so much, as always, for all your work.
Thank you, Sonali.
Mitch Jezrich is a Pacifica reporter, host of Letters and Politics, heard on KPFA and KPFK. He's been covering the impeachment inquiry in Washington, D.C., and has been our impeachment correspondent. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.